We have a guest here, Ellen. You want to introduce our guest, Ellen?
Sure. Just got my microphone ready here.
Okay.
Matthew Fredericks is with us today, and he has so many hats, I don't know which ones to emphasize. I would say he's an author, a teacher, an urban designer, an urban planner, an architect, and has how many books?
I have nine.
Nine published. And how many more in the computer ready to go?
I have two more in the series and a bunch more that are not under contract, but they're residing in my brain somewhere.
Uh-huh.
The series Matthew is referring to is 101 Things I Learned in and it's a variation on school. The latest one, he works on all of them, but he's lead author on two. One is on architecture school, and the new one is on urban design school. Was that actually a different degree than your architecture degree?
No, and actually there are very few urban design degrees out there. So my degree is in architecture, and a lot of people who are urban designers would never say they went to urban design school. It's
So basically you took one degree and you got two books out of it.
Yeah.
Smart.
If you think of a third, let me know.
How to draw charrettes. Is that what they're called? Charrettes? What do you call those little models that you do?
A charrette is not
what is a charrette?
Object.
Oh, what is it?
Charrette,
it's a process.
If I understand correctly, and charrette is, I believe, the French word for cart. And it became used by architecture students because they would be so busy preparing their final projects that, in theory, they would be loading up a cart with all of their goodies, their models, their drawings to take to class.
So it's everything.
And they would actually be working on the project in the cart while a friend pushed them to class.
There you go. See, Ellen? You learned.
We've
already learned something.
So you're...
Call that 102 things.
En charrette when you're trying to write a grant proposal and the deadline is looming overhead.
Right? Oh, thank you, Ellen, for adding to that.
And you rush to the post office.
Being pushed in your cart.
Yeah, right.
So you started the series. Was your architecture one the first one in the series?
Yes, it was.
And it's been successful, obviously, or publishers wouldn't continue it. And you've moved from an academic press to a more commercial press now. You went from MIT to Hachette. Now you're with Crown, one of the imprints of Crown. So that's pretty telling that these books must sell.
The architecture book has done great, and it came out in 2007. And I figured realistically it would sell a few thousand copies and then would kind of die. It was written for college, beginning students of architecture. And it turned out MIT Press is brilliant at getting the book into gift stores and hotel lobby stores. Every odd little niche where somebody might buy a book, they got it in there. And these kinds of stores can actually move more books than bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the little big books? They were thick.
Yes.
But small.
Matthew's too young.
That's true.
The thick little books of cartoons and comics and stuff like that. Yeah. Well, a lot of people collect those.
These books are small.
Oh, I see what you mentioned, because it's kind of designed in the same size.
Not as thick.
And the key is there's 101, not pages, but 101 thoughts, some as long as a full page. In that, some is just a quotation, and on the opposing page or opposite page, there's usually a drawing. And you did all the drawings, right?
Yes.
There are a couple, you know.
I stole a couple.
A couple clip art kind of things.
No.
Right, not clip art, but from other sources. I have a question for you. So, on those other books that where you weren't the primary author, did you do the drawings, or you just sort of helped the author design the book?
Well, the way we do the books and the way I thought we would do them are very different. So when we first signed a contract to do a series, Culinary School, Fashion School, Film School, Business School, I thought that the co-authors would write the book and I would edit and illustrate.
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent that's true, but more often it feels that they teach me what they know and I put it into the format of the book. So I'm the translator. A lot of experts don't know how to present their knowledge in these little chunks.
Right.
So I end up kind of writing them. They're looking over my shoulder, and they look at what I've done. They say, hey, this is great, Matt. It's also all wrong, but it works in the format, so then they have to edit me instead of somewhat instead of the other way around.
So I hope with that new arrangement, you're doing more like you 75%, they get 25%.
Wait, are we talking payment or workload?
So the latest one, there are two new ones. I have the other one at home. I left it at home. But this one is really the one we're here to talk about. It's by you and Vikas Mehta. Now, he's an academic in the same topic. Who did the first draft? Or did you? How did you work together?
Fantastically. Vikas and my approach to urbanism are incredibly sympathetic. So I was going to go with somebody that was very different and complimentary, but this turned out to be the right way to go. Because the books work the way they do, 101 lessons totaling 202 pages, you can write each lesson separately from everything else in the book. So there's almost no first draft, no second draft. You can bring one lesson to 100% or 95% very quickly, and then you'll have other lessons that you try in the beginning, they don't work, and then you come back to them the day before submission and you get them to work. So it's very unusual. There's no first draft, second draft. It's really work on all 101 and then see which ones come along most effectively.
I read it straight through. Do you think of it as having a narrative arc, in the sense of like this idea flows to this idea, flows to that idea? Or do you see it as kind of not random, but discrete ideas?
Well, let me back up just if I may, because all the books follow.
We got a lot of time.
Oh,
and we're easy, man. We're totally easy.
And I'm waving my hands in the air a lot as we talk because your listeners will want to see what I'm talking about. The architecture book, I wrote it for architecture students because architecture school is this horrible muddle for almost everyone. And I hear students say, I went 5 years and I don't think I learned anything. And this is because everything you learn is so interdependent on everything else you learn that if you try to get one thing to hold still, the next thing you learn tends to take it away from you. And you will get very good architects and teachers coming in and telling you very opposite things from each other. And it's not to say that one of them is wrong and another's right. You just have to figure out how it meshes. So my approach with these books, and starting with the architecture book, was to teach one thing at a time that would hold reasonably still so that the student wasn't constantly undermined by the next thing that they learn. And, granted, some of the things don't stand still, but they're close enough, I think, for a starting point.
Do you think with urban design, it's even more, there's a greater variety of thinking about urban design than there is, say, in architecture? I mean, obviously in architecture, people have different views of what looks good, what looks bad. But in urban design, it seems to me you get in, maybe not, but on the surface, it seems you get into far more complex issues about how people relate to each other, how a city operates. I mean, it just seems to expand in a way that could keep you thinking forever.
It's huge, and it bleeds into other
That's
fields.
That's the word I'm looking for. Bleeds into other fields.
Huge, yes. public policy.
Yeah.
Urban design and urban planning are actually two different but overlapping things. So urban design bleeds into urban planning, which takes in issues like economics and demographics and geography and public policy and
zoning.
Yeah,
that's the thing I kept thinking about.
Your world.
Yeah, right.
So my co-author Vikas on the urban design book, he said to me early on that he felt that urban design was more, I think he said scientific. I don't like that word. I'm not sure that's how he meant it. But what he was trying to say is that urban design lessons, you can actually concretize them more because you can point to the behaviors of people in the aggregate and begin to quantify them. I think it's the first lesson in the book.
Yeah, and you get that impression from the book as well that a lot of these are testable. You know, it's like, yes, that's just to take a random one. I was in some planning about there's a big CAS project here locally, and I've been on some of those meetings, and someone commented on, he said, I see a lot of gray space for all this parking. And I'm thinking to myself, but he's looking at it from above. That's not, as you point out, the way to look at a project, really. You want to see it from the ground level. Of course, there's going to be a lot of gray space if there's parking in any situation, but that's not really how we experience an urban design from up above, as you put it. Come down from the helicopter, I believe, was the line in your book, wasn't it?
How much parking?
Yeah, all right.
It's both and. Yeah. You're right. One lesson is get out of your helicopter or land your helicopter, because we can fall in love with computer visualization software or even in freehand drawings, drawing aerial views that have a certain look and appeal to them, but they don't relate to what people see and experience on the ground. That said, there is at a very basic level a certain ratio of what we might call figure to ground, that is solid built buildings to open space, that works in urban areas and that doesn't work. So if you look at the blocks on Warren Street, for example, those blocks are around 50% solid, that is open space, mostly in the backyards, and 50% building. In Rome, it's about, I think, 90 or more percent solid. Solid built space. When I say solid, obviously, these are buildings that you can inhabit. But at a certain aerial level of examination, you find in the more enjoyable, successful urban environments, the coverage is much higher. So when you get down in Hudson to the waterfront, and the Kaz warehouse is down there, there's so much open space. I'm not sure people realize how much of that would need to be built on to have an area in which people really will want to walk.
And in fact, your book even uses some examples from Hudson in the drawings.
That's true.
including our wonderful 7th Street Park, which is a disaster, and some of our pocket parks, and that little bizarre park on, where is it? Is it the one on Green? No,
Columbia?
On Columbia. Columbia.
You mean the triangle?
The
triangle.
Is that the triangle shape?
With the Olympic torch.
No, it wasn't. Was it that one?
This would be up.
Yeah,
the
Columbian Green.
It was at the northeast or eastern corner of the city.
Yeah.
It's Green Street and Columbia, and it is one of the streets called Columbia Turnpike. I get confused.
Yeah.
But, it's so Little Deb's Oasis is right there. Yeah. There's that weird little traffic island that has a monument in it. Did you say it was?
Yes, it's an Olympic torch.
Olympic torch.
Yeah. Some people call it the Olympic ashtray.
it's whatever it is, and I've never gone up to it to really see, but it loses its dignity because it's lost in that traffic island. So one of our lessons is, I believe it's, we said, engage the orphan. And the orphan is that traffic island that everybody drives around, nobody visits. And if you rearrange, not even rearrange the traffic patterns, but simply eliminate one of the through street patterns and engage that orphan to the sidewalk. So in this case, imagine if that triangle that contains the little monument was engaged to the Little Deb Vassalo side of the street. You would have potentially a lovely little plaza.
Right, because you still have the two-way traffic on the other side.
You can still get through
the intersection. You wouldn't really destroy anything.
Right.
I mean, you'd lose some parking spaces, but
well,
not
potentially
that
you gain curbside parking.
Right, because there's no curb space there existing.
So that I adapted it slightly. I don't think the one in the book is exactly that one.
Right.
It's really close.
And you clearly have strong opinions about how do we solve this 7th Street Park dilemma.
Yes. And
the dilemma being?
That it's a nightmare.
Well, yeah.
It's not user-friendly.
Right.
It's ugly. It's, as the book points out, and I've agreed with this before I even read it in the book, too many ugly trees preventing any visual sense of the place. They're not good trees. They're all those.
They redid Bryant Park and they redid Union Square Park in New York.
So the recommendation in the book for a park like that is you don't clog the middle of a park with trees. You put them on the edge, around the rim. That's what you do with trees.
Yes. Imagine if the trees that are now clustered in the center of the park were at the edge of the curb on the opposite side of the street along the where the shops and the buildings currently are. And I'm not saying to simply deforest the park, but what you do is you expand the experience zone of the park so that anybody parking a car or walking down that part of the street, shopping in those shops, actually feels like they're in the space of the park.
I'm told that they're all Norwegian maples, and that Norwegian maples are horrible trees anyway. They're invasive trees, so just get rid of them.
They're really dense and dark.
Well, that was the other thing. You know, it's amazing how you don't, I mean, I don't think about these things, but you point out the difference between trees that develop more on top and create a kind of arc over things, rather than trees that begin from the bottom really thick and mm-hmm. just create density that you don't really want at that level. Nothing wrong with density overhead.
I don't want the railroad track to run through there.
Well,
little late.
You can design
that.
Around that, right? Is it okay calling you Matt, or do you prefer Matt?
Problems are opportunities, and that is a particularly unique thing that mm-hmm. we have, and we don't have the opportunity to lament it or to change it. So mm-hmm. I would look to celebrate it. If we were redoing that park, on my long-neglected blog, Hudson Urbanism, a year or more, probably, which means 3 years ago, I did a proposal for that park, a number of proposals for the park. And on one of them, I was looking at the edges, and the far edge where the Citgo station mm-hmm. now is the worst edge. Mm-hmm. So one of the first things we have to learn about urban space is it needs to be well-defined. People generally in a civic context avoid open spaces, and even though they don't know it, we tend to congregate in spaces that mm-hmm. have definition. So that Citgo side needed a better edge. And in doing that, I ended up proposing a sort of a tunnel built over with a beer garden above mm-hmm. right outside of your old office mm-hmm. Where the radio station used to be. Mm-hmm. And then reworking the gas station so that we get an edge mm-hmm. Over there.
Yes.
So the train coming through the tunnel onto the square became sort of a feature, something
yeah.
they anticipated.
Pretty cool.
And then if you could look at other things, like there is that park has a pretty strong slope from what's the name of the street on the upper side of the park? Is it Park Place?
Park Place. Yeah.
So from Park Place down to 7th, mm-hmm. there's actually a drop of, I don't know, 3 feet, maybe 4 feet, which you can easily miss. But that's a great opportunity to sort of zone the park for different activities. So I like the idea that maybe you could put the train in one zone and you could have steps going up or down so that you could sit and watch the train.
Yeah, there are a little flight of steps there.
In the middle of nowhere, sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right in the middle. Mm-hmm. What you said you designed all these. What happened to the design? Who did you give them to? Who were you? You weren't working for anybody, I assume.
No, these were what ifs on my mm-hmm. my blog.
Oh, on your blog.
And largely in response to there was a lot of public conversation at the time because Hudson was in the loop to get, I think, $300,000 or $400,000 mm-hmm. to use toward the mm-hmm. park. And so some studies were done through the official channels that got me thinking, and then I tried mm-hmm. Some of my own out. I don't think we mentioned, can I plug my talk at the
sure.
library?
Oh, no, we were going to mention that. May 24th?
May 24th at 6. So I'll be presenting some foolish ideas like this. And mm-hmm. The idea being, I'm calling it an urban designer's imaginings, what ifs and why nots. Just trying some ideas out and getting some dialogue going on things like the park.
After reading 101 Things I Learned in Urban Design School, I wanted to get a copy for everybody who's on a certain committee that I'm on that is talking about the CAS building, because I don't think on the one hand we are aware that eventually there will be urban designers involved in this project, but there's a lot of conversation covering these topics by people who really have no clue about these kinds of things. I'm not saying I do, but this book made me realize what I don't know about thinking about big projects like that. How do we integrate a large space like that, as you mentioned, into the city proper sight lines, proper integration with walking paths and everything else? That's a huge, huge project. Do you have ideas?
I think a big part of what an urban designer does is look for existing patterns and then attempt to extend or reinforce them. So you mentioned the CAS warehouse. Now, part of that was taken down, mm-hmm. I think, as part of the development of the hotel.
The hotel yeah.
did it on their own dime because they wanted a better view.
And I don't know all that was going on, and mm-hmm. but what I saw is if you the train station is very isolated, mm-hmm. And we can talk about why that is. That whole end of Hudson works in a certain way that we can talk about. But you get off the train, and if you pass through or walk around the train station, and you're a visitor, you think, where am I? Mm-hmm. How do I get to anything? Mm-hmm. So there's a real good sense of connection. So one thing I looked at is that coming off of Third Street or Route, is it 9G?
Yes.
That there are several, two, I think, dead-end streets, mm-hmm. right there, or mm-hmm. at least one. I think it's called Montgomery Court.
Right.
That, if Montgomery Court were run all the way through it would run between the Cas Warehouse
correct.
And the hotel.
That is called Montgomery Court still. And that is Montgomery Court
Montgomery
extended.
Street, I
Montgomery
thought.
Street, right.
Anyway.
And I think it used to run through. If you look at the old pictures of the city, it ran through.
Yes.
And would run through and point right to the front door mm-hmm. of the train station so that when the train station could be a lovely terminus to an axis. So when the Cas building, part of it was taken down right away, I thought, we lost the opportunity for a little streetscape there. So the hotel gained a view, but they lost an opportunity to be on a street, and that's a real problem down in that area, is that buildings are all kind of on their own. They don't help each other out.
Right. Mm. And when there is, the problem of there is that little CSX building that will not be moved, basically. That's kind of just like
that CSX plopped. Building was an interesting experience because CSX had this really scrubby-looking trailer further down, I think on the waterfront or on one of those slips where the water comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to move it, and they were going to build a permanent building. And we said we didn't want a blue and white building, with their logo all over it.
And by the way, when Ellen says we, she means she. She was very powerful back then.
No, stop. There were a number of people that were arguing this. I don't know mm-hmm. how and CSX is not easy to deal with, nor is Amtrak, as you can see from what they're trying to do with putting up fences. But they were persuaded finally that they would build a building, with taking some advice from the design from us. And so we got them at least to build a brick building. When I say we, I don't even remember who we was. It was not an organized, freestanding committee or anything like that. But and to not have their logo all over it. And it's where the guys go when they check in and mm-hmm. or hang out waiting for the next train to come. Mm-hmm. But they left, I think, that old... Wasn't there?
Crane.
Was some. The
crane is still there. Yeah.
Yeah. We asked that the crane be left.
Mm.
But that it takes a lot of energy for people in the community to get involved like that.
Are there other aspects of Hudson that scream out to you for good urban design?
Many. why don't you steer me and I'll. See what we have.
Well, let's talk more about that because, with the DRI money, one of the projects is wayfaring. And
Wayfinding.
Sorry, wayfaring.
I'm
in the Middle Ages.
Can we do away with that term and
why?
A lot of others? I don't know. It makes me bridle.
Why?
Wayfinding.
Why? Because you always can find your
directions?
Way. How do you feel with the term wayfinding?
Well, it's in the book.
I didn't want to point it out, but
you're steering me. It's too late. It's too late.
Mm-hmm.
It was a term, if not created by Kevin Lynch, certainly popularized by him in a great book called The Image of the City back in late 50s, early mm-hmm. 60s, I believe. And wayfinding means finding your way. And the best kind of wayfinding is the kind that doesn't require signs or a map or any specific directions.
Interesting.
So he identified five categories of elements that we use to find our way around a city. So, for example, a landmark, such as a major monument, that you can see from multiple angles. Every time you see it, you realize, I know where I am. And even if I'm a little lost, you see the landmark and you say, wait a minute, I'm not lost, and I can figure this out. So it lends a sense of confidence and moving around the city. Down there at the waterfront, there's almost no sense of, there are no cues that really help you figure out where you are. So mm-hmm. it just becomes this very bleeding, aimless space. And every time you go down there, you know how to get back, but I think it tends to thwart exploration.
I know somebody, an architect, as a matter of fact, who I think lives in Chatham. And she used to come down, bring her car down Warren Street, turn left on Front and go to the railroad station. She never knew that you could go up the steps and Promenade Hill and see the river. She never knew this, and she'd lived here all her life. I mean,
that is a real problem. Yeah. So if you look at most riverfront towns, the way they tend to be organized is that there's a road, a major through route along the river. That so if it's a north-south river, there's a north-south through route that connects to other towns, mm-hmm. and then the rest of the town kind of works off of that. Here in Hudson, the through route is 3rd Street, which is three blocks in from the river.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually not a through route because when it comes into the city from the south, it enters in and then it doesn't go through. You
right.
actually have to take a right onto Warren Street or Columbia or State to find your way through the rest of the city. I think it used to go through, by the way. But what this tends to do is to create the areas west of 3rd Street. It tends to turn them into a bit of a dead end. So once you go down there, whether you're going by car or walking, you tend to retrace your steps and come back the same way and as I said, not explore. So if I'm walking down Warren Street to go to the Promenade Hill Park, I go down to the park. I can look out over the water, which is terrific, but I can only walk left and right, north and south, only a little bit.
Right.
It doesn't connect to anything. So
correct.
I would love it if working northward from
down
that
to
point.
The waterfront. Is what
well, to the thing. Left and south. Yeah,
Alan has always been an advocate for getting Promenade Park, some people in Promenade Park, some way down to the water.
Right. So we would need a pedestrian bridge over the Amtrak
yeah.
line. And then some way down. And then going to the north, it would be terrific if a pathway could connect to where the Kite's Nest site is, the Fergari
mm-hmm.
area,
mm-hmm.
and the Greenport Conservation District.
I think that's probably going to happen.
When you're looking at something like that, isn't it important, or how much does it matter to understand the history of how it got there to be that way?
A lot. I think when we screw up projects, it's because there was something embedded in the history that we missed.
Yeah.
So a lot of the time, you want to go back and find out, how did this area used to work? Because there are patterns in there that that hold up no matter what.
Right, because, you know, there were all those tanks down there, and there was, you know, a whole industrial complex down there that must have determined how some of these things evolved.
Yeah, and you can also see what happens when someone doesn't respect what happened. So when I moved to Hudson, I was really stunned at the apartment.
When was that?
That was 2010.
2010.
And I was stunned at the development on the river. What is it called? River Court? River View?
The terraces.
Okay. That this is what landed on the river on such a prominent site. And, of course, I found out that
wanted to be on the river. It was dirty, and there were oil tanks and all of that.
Mm. But what was built had nothing to do with what was there before, which, in fact, there was a west side to Front Street that is no longer there. So when you ignore what was there, you end up with something that tends to be alien from the rest of the system.
And how do you correct things? How do you correct mistakes? You can't just tear down stuff. Or can you?
As bad as the mistakes may seem, yeah, I don't like tearing them down. I'd like to say, can you build on that? Because even the mistakes are part of the history. So if you were to say, well, how do we fix the terrace apartments? Am I calling that the right name?
Mm-hmm.
How could that become more of more integrated into the life of Hudson? Well, you would need some physical intervention, but I would love it if we could just say, let's liberalize the zoning on that site. Imagine if I think one of our prominent artists lives in that development. Am I mistaken?
Earl Swann.
Earl lived there. So imagine. I'm not saying Earl wants to open a studio in his apartment, but if he did want to, and if he could, how wonderful that would be to pull people down there to see his work. And there must be other people like him in that apartment complex that have skills that they could be showing off to us.
I know you and I have had this conversation long ago on the radio about zoning, and it's an issue that plagues me personally because I try to understand zoning. I try to understand what makes for a vital city and how zoning plays into that. In fact, through Raising Places, we're going to be inviting a group here who works on zoning and tries to teach zoning to everyday people, ordinary people. Because I think a lot of people locally don't understand how important it is to how a city evolves and how a city develops. As you pointed out, a lot of people don't understand, for example, we have an area that's zoned for single-family homes. And not only is it zoned for single-family homes, but the code regulations are so restrictive in terms of how far it has to be away from the street, how far it has to be away from the house next to it. Not ideas that really make for a vibrant city. They make for a suburban area. Right. That's what suburbanites theoretically want. In terms of our city, I mean, should zoning be a free-for-all? I mean, should it be, is no zoning a good policy? I mean, look at Houston, obviously, that's the great example.
Look at Greenport.
Well, Greenport doesn't have zoning, and yet it does. It have restrictions. You can't just do anything.
Well, it has a very good planning board, I think.
Right. Their planning board has to look at it. I mean, I've gone to enough of their meetings to see that, you know, they have to, a lot of things they have to consider, even though they don't technically have zoning.
Right.
You know, they still have to listen to people. They still have to have public hearings. And if you're living next to something, you get to complain and they listen. But in a denser area like Hudson, it's a totally different model. So what do you recommend in terms of how should we change the zoning? Should we have, what kind of zoning should we have?
Right. So if zoning is a free-for-all, that doesn't work, right?
Mm-hmm.
If zoning is overly restrictive, then I think we lose opportunities for business development that is useful to the community, and then we end up having to drive to Greenport mm-hmm. for the things we need. So how can we make Hudson more walkable? How can we give it more of the uses that allow us to shop here, spend our money here, so the money stays in our community? Zoning had the best of intentions when it came around. If you go back to the 19th century city, heavily industrial, very dirty. You could put a slaughterhouse or a paint factory next door to a school or a nursery or an apartment building, and that was a very bad thing. But we threw the baby out with the bathwater because we basically said, you know what, let's get commercial uses in their own space, all commercial uses, away from residential. Well, that means now that you can't put a clothing store, a used bookstore, a light assembly cabinet shop near residences, and this is detrimental. So how do you allow the right kinds of things? First of all, I would say we have to get rid of the parking requirements. So as example, I live on Union Street, mm-hmm. and I'm actually, my area of Union Street is zoned CC, is a central commercial, mm-hmm. same as Warren Street.
Right.
But
where,
you don't,
what block is
I am in the 400 block. So I believe the 400 and 500 block are CC, mm-hmm. but you really don't see shops going in. Why is that? And it's because there are a certain number of parking spaces required if anybody mm-hmm. were to put a shop in. Well, the problem with doing that is if you create enough parking, then you start to destroy the walkability of the environment. You start paving over usable yard areas,
sure.
and this sort of thing. But on the other hand, if you were to put a shop in without any parking, well, it would hope if you're the proprietor, if people can't drive to your store, well, that's because you're depending on walk-up traffic, and that becomes a service to Hudson. Now, let me just back up a second. I tend to put development into two categories. One I call subjective, one objective. So subjective development is local development. That's somebody who owns or rents an apartment in the city that wants to create a little shop. That's subjective development, and I think that's good for the community. Objective development is when Dunkin' Donuts wants to come in and put up a, mm-hmm. a drive-through restaurant. That's very bad. That is not good for
the
city.
Well, you know, we've banned formula stores here, so we've taken care of that.
That makes me nervous too,
yeah.
because you know I believe in the free market, but
right.
But that's a step. Another thing we could do is we could look at structuring the property tax so that so-called alien or interloper tenants, CVS.
Mm-hmm.
What do we have any other chains in town?
No.
I don't know if you count Mexican Radio.
There's a Subway, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, there is
Green
a Subway.
Street.
Yeah, Green Street has a Subway.
That if you're renting to an alien,
mm-hmm.
I can't think of a better word, but an outside tenant,
Stewards, yeah.
that the property tax rate ought to be greater, or
mm-hmm.
if there's issues with that, there would be a surcharge of some kind.
That's interesting.
Because these are places that are removing money from the locality,
right.
so they should be paying some of that back. So I think things like this can be
done.
And
that's legal? You can get away with that?
There are cities and states that do very similar things, and you have to be a little bit careful for various legal reasons, but there are cities that do give preference to local owners. I think there's something here in New York State.
Yeah.
I forget what it's called, but the star exemption or something like this.
Oh, the star exemption is key to age.
And is that's owner-occupied units? So maybe I'm thinking of a different...
No, that's for residential star. I believe. I don't think it affects
star
business
exemption?
At all. Yeah.
I get a star exemption.
Yeah, it's for residential units. I don't think it's for business
for
at all.
For owner-occupied
yeah.
residential.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, no, these are all interesting things. And, you know, the moment, as you can see, I'm in government these days, and these questions keep me awake at night, you know? I mean, they really do. I just wonder, you know, here's the bigger question. Do you think when you're talking about zoning, you need a real comprehensive plan that sort of reimagines an entire city? Or can it be an ad hoc piecemeal kind of thing to correct?
Wow, great question.
See, Ellen, I can ask good questions. Sorry, just
Who was it who said, was it Eisenhower who said that the point of a plan is to not follow it?
Yeah.
You have to have one, but you're always going to change. But it creates a sense of vision of something that you're working toward. It concretizes community ideals as to whether certain spaces will be open space, whether some areas will be industrial and
but
so forth.
It's driving me crazy right now about the waterfront because the LWRP has still not been approved by the state. And then there's the whole CAS project. And there are all these things that are the Sloop Club.
All these things in play. And do you think it needs a huge vision or can it be done piecemeal?
My idea of piecemeal might even be smaller grain than you're thinking. And I agree, Ellen. There's this problem of ownership down there at the waterfront where you're trying to create something cohesive, but there are different owners that have different ideas about what it should be. But look at the part of Hudson that works best. To me, that's Warren Street.
Right.
I mean, we've got a number of amenities here, proximity to wildlife, the river, and so forth. But Warren Street is pretty darn special. It's, is it nine blocks? Mm-hmm. Very long blocks
mixed-use.
Of urban fabric. It's like a piece of Brooklyn got floated up river, and it's a real amenity.
And it meets all those old criteria of being, you know, you can break up your walk constant, you know, pretty regularly by going side streets. You know what I mean? It's not one long extended street. You wouldn't even want this street paved out. I mean, you know, cars to come off it.
Right. That's right. Cars have benefit to
cars,
urban
cars
places.
Cars are really, because you mentioned that, and I was amazed to realize there are that few streets, because I lived in Charlottesville, Virginia for a while, they paved over the thing. And it kind of worked. I don't know if it still works, but at the time they were desperate about their downtown.
Oh, you mean they closed it to traffic?
They closed it to traffic.
That has been actually proposed.
I know. It's a terrible idea.
The planning board, I think, or the comprehensive plan,
there was a
plan to close down the 500 and the 600 block, I think.
Here? Is that?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And when
it
was
didn't
that?
Get very far. I don't know, but
2002? The comprehensive plan?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I
but as your book would
time.
Point out, then you'd have everybody entering Warren Street from behind. So that it would completely change, right? You encountered what happens, it would probably detract.
I may have a copy of it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Or, according to your book, people would start focusing their entrances in the back. I mean, it's like...
Yes, so there's
that's
a lesson.
That's what Rhinebeck has. They have,
do they really?
Yes.
Yeah,
the front moves to where the cars are.
Right.
And there have been many examples of cities that have tried to do this, either discouraging or prohibiting traffic on the front. And so cars park behind. And how do people who park their cars there get into the buildings and the retail establishments? Well, that's a real problem. They don't feel like walking the whole way around the block. So a lot of these stores then put doors on the back, and they lock the door facing the street. And you end up with the exact opposite effect of what you wanted.
Right. So Warren Street is our success, and part of that is its mixed use, right? I mean,
and it's fine grain. It's what's a typical property width on Warren Street? It's 20 feet or something, 24 feet. They're very narrow properties. And
oh, by that you mean rather than have just like one building being, say, a whole city block? Is that what you mean?
Right, exactly.
Because when you have that, according to your book, then you kind of have a boring space, right? I mean...
Yeah, so when we look at developing sites today, and there have been proposals like this for the CAS site and others, we immediately look at developing the whole block. And Hudson is in demand. So why aren't we taking these sites, maybe dividing them up into 24-foot wide parcels a la Warren Street, which we're all sitting here saying that is our jewel. And that would foster a scale of development that I think would be much more sympathetic to what's already going
interesting, on. Interesting, because in talking about CAS, I think people have been very aware of height, because you want something consistent with the rest of the city, height-wise. But I like the fact that you're saying, you know, to be consistent with a historical district, it's not enough to just, like, have brick for brick or color for color. There are all these more important things to think of in terms of consistency. And what you're pointing out right now is one of those things. Now, the question I have for that is, how does that, what are the economic consequences of building smaller blocks rather than big blocks?
I mean, what do you see the economic result of building the big blocks?
Well, no, I'm just saying, from the developer's point of view, how does that work? Are they saving money by building the bigger?
They are, but who is this mystery developer? Right, yeah. It's almost always going to be somebody from out of town. So right. we set the whole development process up to attract an expert developer who can handle a big project. Mm-hmm. And when that building is eventually built and the rent checks are written each month, who's getting the money? We're sending the money out of town. So why are we setting up this model that is taking money out of the community? If you divide it up into separate properties and you encourage residential occupancy, commercial development by those people in their own space, you get people who are personally invested in Hudson, and they are more likely to spend more of their money in Hudson. If they open commerce, it's more likely to be uses that you and I need.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, this is a very radical idea. You're saying instead of bringing one outside developer to develop that whole CAS space, level what's left, you know, the junky part that's still there, prepare it for as a site, and then create individual properties, perhaps.
Yeah, perhaps. And if, you know, on any one site, we can always get ourselves into trouble because that might not work. But mm-hmm. as a general approach, if I may just shift the conversation. So I mentioned earlier that Third Street used to go through. Mm-hmm. So if you're coming from the south and you enter the city at Third and Warren, and then you proceed to Columbia and State Street, another half a block or so, it peters out. And then it goes down a hill. Mm-hmm. At least the old drawings show that it went through it. It must have been a very steep street, but
yeah. Same thing with this. You know, Second Street used to go all the way down.
Second used to, and still does, right?
No, it's a walkway.
Which is the one?
That's the walkway. Second.
Which is the? There is a street.
No, there's a paved road.
I think it's Second that goes through, right?
It goes.
What do you mean it goes through?
Yeah.
It doesn't go down the hill.
Yes, it does. Second Street, yes.
Into what?
It goes down toward
the old Button Factory.
Toward the factory.
You're talking about the north way. I'm sorry. I'm talking the south.
Heading north.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Oh. I misunderstood. I'm in south. The south used to go through too.
So a few years ago, when Don Moore was council president, mm-hmm. he took note that we have a couple acres out by the high school that mm-hmm. are developable land.
Yeah.
And he wanted to, I don't know what happened, but he said we could sell this and make some money.
It wasn't ours. It was this high school, and it's become a solar
field. A solar field?
Field, yeah.
Well, moot point, but if I can use the example, I was thinking, if we were to do that and sell it off, whatever gets built, there's going to be a piece of suburban sprawl.
Right.
Yeah.
And would it be conceivable that the city could kind of reach out and interact with it? So I looked at extending Third Street all the way out, and it would, you know, sort of behind the fireman's home all the way out to that site. And then is it conceivable we could develop a whole new neighborhood mm-hmm. on the mm-hmm. Warren Street kind of principles of fine-grained and mixed use and so forth?
Well, even if we could get Third Street just to interact more with Charles Williams Park, which it doesn't now. You know, it's a steep incline.
Right.
And no one goes to it that way.
Are there steps that go through?
There may be, but I don't think they're well-maintained. It's just not a good...
Well,
nobody wants to use it.
What is now called Second Ward Foundation
is there, yeah.
Was the Charles Williams School, mm-hmm. and the kids, that was their playground down mm-hmm. there. And I think at one point there was a way to get down. I think it was like...
Yeah, and that's on the southern side.
Kind of stairway.
Right, that's on the southern side. Yeah. On the northern side is where Charles Williams Park is now. And it's an underused site for a whole complex of reasons.
It's damp. It's like... mosquito-y. And
yeah, that needs a lot of
the kids
thought.
Were told they could play soccer there, and they were playing in their bare feet, and they said there were snakes.
Yeah, and there was supposed to be a skate park, and they put down the wrong surface for a skate park. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just a disaster. But getting back to the developable part, I'm obsessed with this CAS thing, and I hope, as a citizen of Hudson that you are, that you will participate in the future discussions about that development, because if a developer is picked, there's going to be a lot of public input.
I was told there would be no homework.
There'll be no homework. But, you know, I mean, these people, certainly the people on the committee who are making these decisions need to hear this kind of information. Presumably, the planners who come with the developers know this stuff. I mean, can you count on that or not?
Well, and you and I have talked in the past about this, I've not been as directly involved in any number of things in Hudson, and part of it is that the kind of ideas that we're talking about now, you can't go to a planning meeting at 7 o'clock and start to raise them unless things are really primed and people are really ready to hear it, because people want to take the existing zoning paradigm and just kind of run that through.
Exactly. And that speaks to that whole parking thing, because you know the obvious answer to your wanting to correct the parking, and it makes total sense on Union, but then you get into a slightly more residential zoned area, and it's like, yeah, you take away the parking requirement, but people are still going to bring in their cars there and living there with their cars, and you're just going to have no more space for everybody. It's just going to be a mass confusion.
Yeah, I think we have a ways to go. You know, keep in mind that if Hudson grows and we focus on allowing mixed uses to emerge organically, then those businesses are going to tend to suit local needs. So you end up with households that where two people don't need two cars, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, it's a good problem to have.
And cars are going to get smaller. Take up less space.
Sure.
True. So many people are driving these minuscule.
But you know, it's funny you said that, because last time we talked, I remember specifically you used the term organically. And I don't know if you remember, that kind of got stuck in my craw, because there's a kind of organic nature to things, but there's also not. That there's so many other things that influence how things develop. And some of them are decidedly inorganic. You know, I mean, that, and I guess you do speak to it when you say, why does an outside developer come through? Because that's pretty inorganic, in the sense of they come in and they skew everything. And as you point out, they can determine what a whole neighborhood's going to look like if they get that project. But don't you think that's kind of something you have to worry about? I mean, you can talk about, you know, things functioning organically, but there's always other things that skew that organicism.
Sure. So where's the balance? So I think it's possible to get the sort of planned, inorganic, objective kind of stuff to work in concert with the more organic, bottom-up, free-for-all stuff. So let me give an example. I actually don't know what the county eventually did with its offices, but a number of years ago they were looking at a number of sites in Hudson for their offices. Mm-hmm. So my question is always, if you're going to create a big building, so it's going to be an object building, what we call in the business an object building. It's big. It tends to stand on its own and be isolated. Can you place an object building, inorganic building, in a way that facilitates private sector bottom-up development? So if you want to locate a parking garage, the last thing you should do is put it where you need it. So if a county office needs parking, how far away from those county offices could you put that parking garage and still have it work, still have it be acceptable? Certainly a block, two blocks, three blocks. I'm not, you know, I don't know what it is. It's different for different projects. Mm-hmm. But whatever that distance is, in the space in between the two sort of inorganic pieces, then you allow in there the mom
Something
and pop,
to happen.
Bottom
Something's
up,
happen.
The fine grain stuff to happen.
Right.
And that's where if you're just spending money on public projects, and you're not using it to foster private sector development, then you're just spending money you're never going to see again.
So when you're developing, say, a housing complex, most people want to park very close to where they live. Does it make any sense to have their parking to be so that they would have to walk by, say, small businesses or small, you know, retail stores that they might need?
That's workable. It's a tough thing to do in Hudson because it's such a small city that people do have an expectation that they can park close to home. But certainly in larger cities, you've seen this, where people pull their car out once a week or once a month.
Yeah.
They will park that several blocks from home.
Yeah, no, that's worth thinking about. I mean, parking, after 2.5 years on the planning board and realizing how almost every site plan had a parking dimension that was constantly plagued, you know, it's just like, can we let this go through without following the code? And the code, as you know, is very restrictive about parking. So it came up on almost every site plan. And if you, you know, if you bend once, you end up bending often, you know. And
one thing, I mentioned subjective development and objective development. So if subjective development is by somebody that lives there, again, they're going to tend to respond to local needs. They're going to tend to want to found a business that they're drawing from folks nearby. So I don't think the needs are the same. I think we inherently tend to assume that development is going to be objective. It's going to be draw people from a long distance. I mean, in some ways, that's good. If we create a restaurant and it draws people from neighboring towns, that's great. But first, let's create these places to feed and fuel local needs.
You know, we've made a mistake here, not identifying you constantly throughout this conversation because we got so tied up. We get so wrapped up in the conversation. It's been so good. We've been talking to Matthew Frederick, who with Vikas Mehta is the author of 101 Things I Learned in Urban Design School. That's his new book, one of nine in the series. And he's the main author on this one. And Elle and I both had a chance to read it. And that's why we're going on so much and forgot.
I didn't get any further than this statement, which...
Oh, really? Well, I read the whole thing. I'm a good student.
I
did my homework.
We believe the essential question for all urban places are and will remain the workaday experiences of ordinary people in ordinary life.
Well, that's absolutely true.
I mean, I get scared to death with the DRI and all this other stuff, you know, and all these new organizations, raising places.
Yeah, well, no, that's not. They don't have any power.
No, I know, but it was interesting. It was very well done.
Thing. They were imagining things.
All this stuff is bubbling up all over the
and
place.
And I understand. You know, you think you're nervous. I'm actually, like, believe it or not, in a position of some power. So I'm a lot more nervous than you because if things screw up, it falls back on people like me.
This is why I told you had to have a kitchen cabinet. You need,
Ellen, you're
smart
my kitchen.
You've people. Always... Well, I don't know anything about zoning and all this stuff. So you need.
Well, that's why we have Matthew in here today to tell us all the things he's learned both in urban design school and architecture school. Urban planning is another category that just. I had a brother who was an urban planner, so I kind of, the moment I read about. You know, so the reference to Kevin Lynch, I could picture that book on his shelf. And, of course, the great Jane Jacobs, who was quoted in Matthew's book. Aren't too many quotations. I figure, you know, he didn't want to get away with too many lazy pages. So you can't have too many quotations. Otherwise, it's just like, that's too easy, right?
The quotes need to sum up something that we've taught maybe in the previous lesson.
Like three or four?
Yeah,
maybe?
That's probably right.
That's all it should be.
And five or six is our maximum.
And on May 24th, we're going to be able to hear more from Matthew. The Future of Hudson, an urban designer's imaginings, what ifs, and why nots by Matthew Frederick.
Yeah.
And you're going to be talking about that book.
And this book, as it relates to our lovely little city of Hudson, as we've been talking here already. Matthew has a lot of ideas about things to do in Hudson. From what I understand, you know, it's a tough town, a tough city. Not many people want to hear it. It's weird, isn't it? How unopen people are. I mean, so many people have so many strong ideas about what is good for Hudson. This is what I've learned also in political office, is how many people, this is the thing that really gets me, is when people say, this is what Hudson needs.
I know.
And it's like...
They all come from out of town. They say, you can go to any meeting and have an impact because it's such a small town.
And
so
you know...
And full of ideas and...
Well, Ellen, as you know, I like to quote to them my favorite line from King Lear, reason, not the need. You know, you can go on and on about what a city needs. I mean, that's such an easy thing to do. And usually it's about the wrong thing. You know, it's like, we need a cobbler. Well, you know, you want to say to somebody like that.
We need a dog park.
Go do it, you know, or figure out how to get it done. It's a small city with a lot of people with a lot of big ideas.
One of the reasons I argue for this liberalized zoning model that would favor residents facilitating their own commercial development, I think often of something Jane Jacobs said, and that is that cities have the capability of providing something for everybody only when they are created by everybody.
Yeah.
So if somebody walks into the city, whether they live here on the weekends or whether they're a developer and says, I know what Hudson needs, Probably not. Yeah. But if it's somebody who lives here and is involved in the community, whatever what they want to do probably is going to be in tune with what the community needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And and Matthew has a lot of ideas because he's a writer and he's a thinker and he thinks about what's good in terms of urban design, urban planning, architecture. And you have an opportunity to hear him talk about Hudson on May 24th at the library.
6 o'clock.
6 o'clock. In the meantime, go buy his book, 101 Things I Learned in Urban Design School. And his first book, 101 Things I Learned in Architecture School, is still available. You know, Ellen, we've gone on so long, we're running out of time. We got to say goodbye.
I know.
WGXC 90.7 FM Acre Hudson Catskill. Ellen, you got something to say?
Exactly what you just said.
Oh, thank you.
This is WGXC 90.7 FM.
And you said it so much more nicely. Bye, and thank you, Matthew.
Thank you.